You're now tuned in to Cognitive Flow, brought to you by OptimalAnesthesia.com, where clinical insight meets focus clarity. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are really plunging into something fundamental, KIM receptors.
Yeah, absolutely. Core physiology. We've got this stack of pretty technical sources, but the goal is simple.
Right. Distill it down, bridge that gap, you know, between the tiny world of ion channels and what we actually do at the bedside.
Our mission, essentially, is to give you the working blueprint. Understand these built-in alarms and thermostats, how they control breathing, heart rate, blood pressure.
And critically, how our anesthetic drugs just throw a wrench in the works.
Exactly. If you understand how they interfere, you stop just chasing numbers and you start managing the actual physiology.
Okay, so to make this stick, let's use that analogy we discussed. The patient's body is like a sophisticated house, right? Needs everything running just so.
Perfect. And the KIM receptors, they're the high-tech sensors in that house. You've got your peripheral KIM receptors. Think of those as super sensitive smoke detectors tuned right into the immediate danger, low oxygen.
Smoke detectors, okay. And the central KIM receptors.
Those are more like the thermostats. Slower, maybe, but robust. They manage the overall CO2 level, keeping things stable minute to minute.
So smoke detector senses fire. Thermostat senses overheating. Alarm bells go off. Triggers the HVAC, maybe sprinklers, fiddles with the power grid all at once.
That's the idea. But here's the kicker for us. Under anesthesia, those smoke detectors, those thermostats, they're often, well, chemically muffled, drugged.
Which means we become the emergency system. The responsibility shifts entirely to the anesthesia team.
You got it. We absolutely have to know the limits of the system we're now managing because the built-in safeties are compromised.
All right, let's dive into the specifics then. Anatomy first. You mentioned two distinct networks.
Yeah, two main types, peripheral and central. They differ in what they sense, where they are, and crucially, how fast they react.
Let's start peripheral, the smoke detectors.
Okay, so peripheral chemoreceptors, mostly found in the carotid bodies, little clusters of cells right where the common carotid artery splits.
The bifurcation.
Exactly. And you also find some in the aortic bodies, near the aortic arch. But for humans, the carotid bodies, they're the main players.
And why are they the fast alarms? What gives them that speed?
It's their wiring. They've got this direct line, Herring's nerve. It's a branch of the glossopharyngeal cranial nerve 9.
Okay.
And it zips straight into the nucleus tractus solitarius, the NTS, in the medulla.
The NTS. That's like the central command for heart and lung sensory info, right?
Pretty much, yeah. It's the main relay station.
Yep.
This direct fast pathway means boom, immediate sympathetic and breathing response. No delay.
And they're mainly sniffing out oxygen, low oxygen.
Exquisitely sensitive to low PaO2, arterial oxygen tension. These cells fire like crazy when the PaO2 drops below, let's say, roughly 60 millimeters of mercury.
60. Okay, that's the magic number often quoted.
It's the threshold, yeah. This is your rapid response system for acute hypoxia, sudden desaturation. These guys sound the alarm, crank up ventilation, and trigger that systemic sympathetic surge.
Do they care about CO2 or acid at all?
They do have a secondary response, yeah, to high CO2 and acidosis. But oxygen, that's their defining feature. That's the primary job.
Got it. Fast alarms, low O2 sensors in the periphery.
Yeah.
Now pivot to the central chemoreceptors, the thermostats.
Right, the thermostats. These are located more diffusely within the ventral surface of the medulla. A key area people talk about is the retrotrapezoid nucleus, or RTN.
And their location is key, you said, in the brainstem, behind the blood-brain barrier.
Exactly. That barrier isolates them from the rapid swings happening in the peripheral blood, so they aren't really watching PO2 directly.
Okay, so what are they watching?
They're primarily monitoring the effects of CO2. Specifically, the acidification that happens when CO2 gets into the cerebrospinal fluid, the CSF.
Ah, so it's a pH thing in the CSF, driven by CO2.
Precisely. They're crucial for maintaining your steady-state acid-base balance, setting your baseline breathing rate and depth. But because CO2 has to diffuse across the barrier and then the chemical reaction has to happen, it's inherently slower.
Makes sense. So they handle the long game, the minute-to-minute CO2 control, not the sudden oxygen crisis.
That's a good way to put it. Peripheral for the acute O2 drop. Central for the steady CO2 regulation.
It's interesting how we rely on both constantly in the OR, maybe without consciously thinking about it. Central keeps the ETCO2 steady. Peripheral is our backup if the tube kinks or something.
And anesthesia doesn't just turn down the volume on these systems. It can actually shift the set points, change how they interact, and that's where the real clinical challenges pop up.
Yeah, you're blinding the fast alarm and kind of messing with the thermostat calibration at the same time.
Exactly. Double whammy.
Okay, let's get down to the nitty-gritty then, the molecular level. How does that peripheral alarm, the glomus cell, actually work? It sounds fascinating.
It really is elegant. We're talking about the type I sensor cell in the carotid body. Think of it, like you said, as a charged battery, constantly monitoring oxygen levels, and the key oxygen sensor. It's often thought to be the mitochondrion itself.
The cell's powerhouse is sensing the lack of fuel, essentially.
In a way, yes. Under normal oxygen conditions, normoxia, the mitochondria, are chugging along happily. This happy state sends a signal. Somehow, we're still working out the details.
Huh?
But it signals the cell surface to keep certain potassium channels open. Specifically, these leak channels, often from the TASC and TREK families, two pore domain K-plus channels.
Okay, so potassium channels are open. Potassium ions, K-plus, flow out down their concentration gradient.
Right. Positive charge leaves the cell. This keeps the inside of the cell negative relative to the outside. It's hyperpolarized. The battery is charged, but quiet. The alarm is off.
Okay, resting state. Then hypoxia hits. PO2 drops below 60.
Now, the mitochondria sense this. The lack of oxygen changes their function. Maybe alters the redox state, maybe involves reactive oxygen species. The exact mechanism is complex.
Right.
But the result is that this internal signal tells those specific oxygen-sensitive potassium channels to slam shut.
Channels closed. Potassium can't leak out anymore.
Exactly. So that positive charge starts to build up inside the cell. The inside becomes less negative. It depolarizes.
And that depolarization is the trigger.
That's the key event. Once the cell depolarizes past a certain threshold, it triggers voltage-gated calcium channels to open.
Calcium rushes in?
Floods into the cell. And the sudden influx of calcium, that's the direct signal for the cell to release its stash of excitatory neurotransmitters. Things like ATP, acetylcholine, maybe dopamine.
Onto the nerve ending of that Herring's nerve.
You got it. A big burst of neurotransmitter release. That's the low oxygen message screaming up the nerve highway to the NTS.
Wow. That is incredibly fast and neat. But what about chronic situations like right. COPD or high altitude? The system must adapt, right?
Yeah.
You mentioned HIFs.
Yeah, absolutely. That immediate response. That's all ion channels. Fast on, fast off. But for chronic hypoxia, the cell shifts gears. It activates a longer-term genetic program involving hypoxia-inducible factors, HIFs, HI1-alpha, and HI2-alpha are the key ones here.
HIFs, like a cellular renovation crew that remodels the cell for low-oxygen living.
That's a great analogy. HIFs act as transcription factors. They go into the nucleus and change which genes are turned on or off. They can alter the number and type of potassium channels, change the cell's metabolism, even promote growth of the carotid body tissue itself.
So that's why people living at high altitude or patients with chronic lung disease have hyper-responsive carotid bodies. The cells have literally rebuilt themselves to be more sensitive.
Exactly. The alarm system has been structurally upgraded to yell louder and faster in response to chronic low oxygen.
Okay, incredibly cool. Now, let's contrast that super-fast electrical-chemical peripheral system with the central mechanism. Much slower, you said, and all about chemistry.
Right. Central chemoreception hinges on diffusion across the blood-brain barrier, the BBB. CO2 is very lipid-soluble, so it slips across that barrier easily, regardless of blood pH buffering.
Up the CSF on the other side, it doesn't have the buffering capacity of blood, does it?
Very little buffer capacity, mostly just bicarbonate, not proteins like albumin or hemoglobin. So once CO2 gets into that poorly buffered CSF, an enzyme called carbonic anhydrase goes to work instantly.
The classic reaction, CO2 plus water makes carbonic acid.
Which then rapidly dissociates into a hydrogen ion, H+, and a bicarbonate ion, HCO3. Because the CSF buffering is weak, even a small increase in CO2 leads to a relatively significant increase in H+ concentration. The CSF becomes more acidic, the pH drops.
So the neurons in the RTN aren't actually sensing CO2 molecules directly. They're sensing the acid, the H+ ion.
Precisely. These specialized neurons, and maybe even surrounding glial cells, have pH-sensitive ion channels on their surface. Things like A6 acid-sensing ion channels and certain potassium channels like TASC-K2.
And when the H+ concentration rises,
it activates these channels. This increases the excitability of the chemosensitive neurons, makes them fire more frequently, and that increased firing rate is what drives the central respiratory rhythm generator located nearby to increase overall ventilation. Breathe faster, breathe deeper.
Okay, so the takeaway seems to be peripheral is fast, electrical, O2 focused, central is slower, chemical, CO2 pH focused, behind the BBB.
You've got it. And understanding that difference is key to understanding how different anesthetics might affect them differently. Fat-soluble volatiles can hit both, but the mechanisms are distinct.
Right. Let's bridge that now. How do these signals translate into system-wide effects?
Mm-hmm.
Why do breathing and blood pressure seem so tightly linked?
This is where it gets clinically super relevant. These chemoreceptors aren't just breathing regulators operating in isolation. They are wired directly into the autonomic nervous system.
We see it all the time, right? Patient's ETCO2 starts to climb just a bit during insufflation,
yep.
And suddenly the blood pressure shoots up 30 points, heart rate jumps 20 beats per minute. That's the autonomic link in action.
Absolutely. Let's take peripheral activation, say acute hypoxemia. That signal rushes into the NTS, like we said. But from the NTS, it doesn't just go to the breathing centers. It gets relayed over to the RVLM, the rostral ventrolateral medulla.
RVLM. The main control center for sympathetic outflow.
Exactly. It houses the sympathetic premotor neurons. The NTS basically tells the RVLM, hey, danger, low oxygen, and the RVLM cranks up systemic sympathetic tone.
So the body's emergency response is multi-pronged, breathe more, and kick in the fight or flight response, vasoconstriction, tachycardia, to maintain perfusion, especially to the brain.
It's a powerful survival reflex. And high CO2 centrally also feeds into augmenting sympathetic activity through shared pathways in the brainstem, although the peripheral hypoxic drive is often considered the more potent acute sympathetic trigger.
But normally, this big sympathetic surge doesn't cause wild hemodynamic swings, does it? There's another reflex involved.
The bear reflex, your built-in blood pressure stabilizer. Stretch receptors in the carotid sinus and aortic arch constantly monitor BP. So, in someone awake and healthy, if that camreflex activation causes BP to spike, the baroreflex immediately senses that stretch, fires off signals to increase vagal tone, slow the heart, and withdraw sympathetic tone, relax blood vessels, to bring the pressure back down.
They're constantly interacting, keeping things in a tight range, a push-pull system.
A constant sparring match, yeah. But here's the absolute crucial point for anesthesia. Our drugs wreck this balance.
How so?
We profoundly suppress the baroreflex. Volatile anesthetics, propofol, high-dose opioids, they all significantly blunt baroreflex sensitivity. They essentially cut the wires on that safety brake for the sympathetic system.
Okay, let's connect the dots. Patient under general anesthesia. Maybe CO2 starts rising because laparoscopic insufflation, or maybe we're hypoventilating them slightly.
Right. The chemoreceptors, central and peripheral, sense this rise in CO2, or maybe a slight dip in O2. They send that alarm signal to the RVLM.
RVLM cranks up sympathetic output.
But now, the baroreflex brake that would normally counter that surge is heavily suppressed by the anesthetic.
So the sympathetic effect is unopposed, exaggerated.
Exactly. It's unmasked or outsized. The hemodynamic response, the hypertension, the tachycardia is way bigger than it would be in an awake person because the normal buffering system is offline.
And clinically, this often gets misinterpreted, right?
Mm.
We see the BP and heart rate shoot up and think,
patient's too light, need more gas, need more propofol.
When actually it's a raw, unbuffered physiological reflex driven by the change in gas tensions.
That distinction is critical because if you just treat the symptom, give Esmolol or hydralazine without fixing the underlying cause, the high CO2.
You're just putting a Band-Aid on that fire alarm, as you said earlier. The underlying stress, the sympathetic drive, is still there.
Correct. The primary intervention has to be eliminating the stimulus driving the chemoreflex. In most ORR scenarios like this, that means fixing the ventilation to bring the CO2 back down.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. Address the cause, not just the effect. Now, let's layer on the drugs themselves. How do our common anesthetics actually do the muffling at the molecular level?
Let's walk through the main players. Start with the workhorses. The volatile anesthetics, SIVO, ISO, DES, their effect is pretty broad.
We know they cause dose-dependent respiratory depression. Is there a common mechanism hitting the chemoreceptors?
Yes. A key mechanism involves those potassium channels we talked about earlier, the TASC and TRK-like channels. These channels are found both in the peripheral glomus cells and in the central respiratory neurons in the medulla.
Okay.
Volatile agents are known to activate these channels, essentially propping them open.
So if the anesthetic keeps the potassium leak channels open, potassium flows out, keeping the cell hyperpolarized. Quiet.
Precisely. It stabilizes the cell membrane in a hyperpolarized state, making it harder for the normal stimuli hypoxia or high H plus to depolarize the cell and trigger firing. It raises the threshold for activation.
So it actively counteracts the alarm signal.
That's right. And because these channels are present peripherally and centrally, volatiles produce a dose-dependent blunting of both the hypoxic ventilatory drive, peripheral, and the hypercapnic ventilatory drive, central. Get up to 1.5 MSE or so, and that hypoxic drive can be almost completely wiped out.
That's a huge safety issue, especially during emergence. If the patient obstructs, their main rapid backup system is gone.
It's a major vulnerability. Okay, now propofol, our go-to IV agent. Its main action seems more focused centrally.
It works on GABA receptors, right? Enhances inhibition.
Primarily, yes. By boosting GABA receptor inhibition and also likely reducing excitatory signals like glutamate in the brainstem respiratory centers, propofol powerfully suppresses central activity. It really dampens that central CO2 sensitivity.
Which explains the common apnea right after induction. You basically switch off that central thermostat function immediately.
Pretty much. Now, the big one for respiratory depression, opioids. Fentanyl, morphine, hydromorphone.
Why are they so particularly dangerous for breathing?
Because they hit the core rhythm generator. They act on mu opioid receptors, which are densely packed in key medullary respiratory areas, especially the pre-Butzinger complex.
The pre-Butzinger. That's considered the main pacemaker for generating the respiratory rhythm itself.
That's the current thinking, yes. It sets the fundamental beat. When opioids bind to mu receptors there, they strongly suppress the activity of those pacemaker neurons.
So they don't just make the system less responsive to CO2, they actually attack the source of the breathing rhythm.
Exactly. They reduce respiratory rate profoundly, can alter the pattern, and make the system much less sensitive to CO2 stimulus. This is the classic mechanism behind delayed post-op respiratory depression, especially when longer-acting opioids are still peaking hours after surgery.
Okay. What about dexmedetomidine? It's often touted as being more respiratory sparing.
It's nuanced. Dexmedetomidine, acting via alpha-2 adrenergic agonism, is generally better than propofol at preserving upper airway muscle tone, so less likely to cause frank obstruction.
Okay, that's a plus.
But, and this is important, it still significantly suppresses central chemorreflex gain. It reduces the brainstem's responsiveness to CO2.
So the patient might look okay, breathing spontaneously open airway, but if their CO2 starts to climb, they won't ramp up their breathing effectively.
That's the risk. They might maintain airway patency, which can be falsely reassuring, but their actual ventilatory response to hypercapnia is blunted. And this effect is definitely additive, maybe even synergistic, when combined with opioids.
Open airway, but poor drive. Tricky combination.
Very. Finally, ketamine, the NMDA antagonist.
This one's different, usually.
Yeah, ketamine is generally considered ventilatory sparing. While it provides analgesia and dissociation, its mechanism blocking NMDA receptors and causing some sympathetic stimulation tends to preserve respiratory drive and CO2 responsiveness much better than GABA agents or opioids.
It also helps maintain airway reflexes and sympathetic tone.
Right, which makes it a really valuable option when maintaining spontaneous ventilation and hemodynamic stability are top priorities.
Okay, that's a great rundown of the pharmacology. But patients aren't blank slates, are they? Their underlying diseases must change how these chemoreceptors function even before we give any drugs.
Absolutely critical point. Chronic disease can drastically alter the baseline sensitivity and function of these systems. We have to know who's coming in with a potentially faulty alarm system already.
Let's talk high-risk groups. Top of the list, maybe COPD.
Definitely. In severe COPD, you often have chronic hypercapnia, high baseline CO2. The central chemoreceptors, bathed constantly in acidic CSF, adapt. They undergo this resetting process.
Their thermostat gets turned way up. They tolerate a much higher CO2 before feeling the urge to breathe more.
Exactly. The central drive becomes desensitized. So what keeps them breathing?
They become dependent on their peripheral hypoxic drive.
Precisely. Those carotid bodies, sensing the chronic mild hypoxemia that often accompanies severe COPD, become the main stimulus keeping ventilation going.
And the huge clinical implication there.
If you give that patient too much supplemental oxygen, crank up the FiO2 and push their PaO2 way above that 60 millimol Hg threshold.
You switch off their primary drive to breathe.
You remove the hypoxic stimulus and boom, acute hypoventilation, even apnea. It's the classic oxygen-induced hypercapnia scenario. We have to carefully titrate oxygen in these folks, often aiming for an SpO2 of maybe 90-92%, not 100%.
Balancing oxygenation against respiratory drive.
Mm.
Okay, what about obesity hypoventilation syndrome, OHS?
OHS is tough. It's a combination platter. You've got the mechanical load of obesity making breathing physically harder, plus often an intrinsic impairment of central CO2 sensitivity. Things like leptin resistance and inflammation seem to play a role in blunting that central thermostat.
So high work of breathing and a poor response to the CO2 buildup caused by that work.
Right. This makes them incredibly vulnerable postoperatively, residual anesthetic, maybe some opioids. It doesn't take much to tip them over into severe hypoventilation or apnea. They often need CPAP or BiPAP immediately after extubation.
Okay. Shifting gears from lungs, chronic heart failure, CHF. How does that affect chemoreceptors?
CHF is fascinating. The chronic low-flow state, the systemic inflammation, it seems to lead to enhanced carotid body sensitivity. The peripheral alarms become hyper-responsive.
Wait, the opposite of blunting, they get more sensitive?
It appears so. Those glomus cells seem to become chronically irritated or upregulated. This means even small fluctuations in oxygen or CO2 can trigger an exaggerated sympathetic response.
And in a patient with a failing heart, that sudden sympathetic surge tachycardia, vasoconstriction could be disastrous.
Exactly. It can push them into acute decompensation. The alarm bell is ringing too loud for the compromised system to handle.
Wow. Okay, one more. Diabetes with autonomic neuropathy.
Yeah, long-standing diabetes can damage the autonomic nerves themselves, both the afferent nerves carrying signals from the sensors and the efferent nerves carrying signals to the effectors. In terms of chemoreceptors, we often see blunted peripheral chemoreceptor responses.
So the fast alarm system itself is damaged, less able to send this signal.
Correct. The danger here is that physiological deterioration, like developing hypoxia or hypercapnia, might be silent. They lose that rapid compensatory surge until things are potentially quite advanced.
Okay, this really underscores why monitoring is everything. We need ways to see what these chemoreceptors are telling us, especially when they might be faulty or muffled.
Absolutely. And our number one tool, the cornerstone, is capnography, ETCO2. Continuous, real time. It's our best window into the central chemoreceptor stimulus, essentially reflecting PaO2.
And crucially, changes in ETCO2 often precede the badness, right? That climb from 38 to 45 often happens before the BP and heart rate surge.
It's often the earliest warning sign of inadequate ventilation or a sudden CO2 load. It has to be paired, of course, with pulse oximetry, SpO2.
SpO2 tells us about oxygenation, the peripheral stimulus side, but with limitations.
Big limitations. It lags behind actual changes in PO2. And more importantly, especially when we're giving supplemental oxygen, it hits that ceiling effect. And SpO2 of 98% tells you the patient isn't profoundly hypoxic, but it tells you nothing about their ventilation or their PaO2 level.
Right. The scenario, SpO2 is 98% on 40% oxygen, but the ETCO2 is silently climbing to 60.
Yeah.
That's an emergency, even though the pulse ox looks great.
Exactly. That's why you need both interpreted together, and it's why we're seeing more interest in advanced monitoring.
Like transcutaneous CO2, TCCO2.
Yeah, TCCO2 provides a continuous, non-invasive estimate of arterial PaO2. It can be really valuable in the PCU or ICU for tracking ventilation in high-risk patients, like those with OHS or after complex surgery, without needing frequent blood gases.
And looking even further ahead, what about actually measuring the brain's output signal, the neurorespiratory drive?
That's a really exciting area. Technologies like diaphragmatic EMG, using specialized EKG leads or esophageal probes, or even electrical impedance tomography, can estimate the intensity of the electrical signal the brainstem is sending down the phrenic nerves to the diaphragm.
So you can see the effort the brain is making to breathe, even before the breathing itself changes.
That's the idea. The neural drive might start to diminish due to deep anesthesia or opioid effect before you see a significant drop in tidal volume or respiratory rate. It could give us the earliest possible warning of impending respiratory failure. Of course, for precise calibration, especially in really complex cases, the arterial blood gas, ABG, is still the gold standard.
Okay, let's try to pull this all together into some practical mental scripts. How do we take this physiology and apply it instantly when things go sideways?
Yeah, we need to hardwire these physiological responses into our clinical instincts.
Okay, case one, the laparoscopy CO2 surge. You start insufflating the abdomen. ETCO2 climbs rapidly, maybe 36 up to 55 millimolar HG. Almost simultaneously, BP jumps from 120 systolic to 170. Heart rate goes from 70s to 110.
The immediate, almost knee-jerk reaction for many is, whoa, patient's light. Reach for the vaporizer, reach for more propofol, maybe grab some Esmolol.
But based on our discussion,
that surge is textbook unmasked chemorflex, driven primarily by that acute hypercapnia stimulating central and maybe peripheral receptors, hitting an RVLM that can't be braked by the baroflex. The root cause is the CO2.
So primary action, fix the ventilation now.
Exactly. Increase the respiratory rate, increase the tidal volume if appropriate for lung protection, get that CO2 washed out rapidly.
And often, as ETCO2 comes back down towards the normal range,
the sympathetic drive evaporates. The BP and heart rate will frequently normalize on their own without any vasoactive drugs needed. That's the physiological fix. Treat the cause. Only if the hypertension is truly severe or doesn't respond quickly to ventilation correction should you consider a short-acting antihypertensive, but you keep correcting the ventilation.
Because just treating the BP leaves the underlying problem untouched. You mask the sign, stress the patient, maybe miss an issue with the insufflator.
You're chasing symptoms, not physiology. It's a trap.
All right. Case two, the COPD patient, post-extubation apnea. You've got your patient with severe COPD in the recovery room. They got maybe 60% IO2 during emergence. They're extubated onto a face mask, still getting high FiO2. CPO2 reads 98%. That they stopped breathing. Pink, maybe cyanotic later, but initially just apneic.
Classic dangerous scenario. You've got the double hit. Residual opioids or anesthetic are still suppressing the central rhythm and CO2 sensitivity. And that high supplemental oxygen has knocked out the peripheral hypoxic drive that this patient was likely relying on.
Alarm is muffled. Thermostat is broken, and the backup generator, hypoxic drive, just got switched off by the high O2.
Perfect summary. So what's the immediate life-saving and maybe counterintuitive move, besides supporting ventilation, obviously?
You have to recognize that the 98% PO2 isn't reassuring as part of the problem. You need to carefully reduce the FiO2.
Exactly. Titrate it down, aiming for a lower SpO2 target, maybe 90, 92%. Allow the PO2 to drift down just enough to potentially re-engage that critical peripheral drive. While doing that, assess for opioid reversal with naloxone. Consider non-invasive ventilation support.
It feels wrong to lower the oxygen on an apneic patient, but physiologically, it might be what they need to kickstart their own breathing again.
In this specific context, yes. It's about restoring their baseline physiological drive. This leads naturally to a kind of CHIM or rapture safety checklist.
Okay, break it down. Pre-op, intra-op, post-op.
Preoperatively, identify. Screen for the high-risk groups known COPD needing home O2. Diagnosed OHS, significant opioid tolerance implies altered central set points, CHF, risk of hyperresponse. Plan your monitoring ETCO2 is absolutely mandatory for these folks. Consider your anesthetic plan in light of these risks.
Intraoperatively, proactive management. Aim for normal capnia, typically ETCO2 35, 45 milliliter HG. If you know a big CO2 challenge is coming, major insufflation, one lung ventilation, increase minute ventilation before the ETCO2 spikes. Be judicious with opioids, maybe lean more on regional or non-opioid adjuncts if appropriate.
Postoperatively, vigilance. Watch closely for delayed respiratory depression, especially as volatile agents wear off and opioid levels might peak. For the known CO2 retainers, COPD, titrate oxygen carefully to avoid suppressing hypoxic drive. Use that target SpO2 range. For OHS patients, have a low threshold for CPAP or BiPAP, maybe even preemptively. Consider TCO2 monitoring if available for high-risk cases.
That's a solid framework. Thinking about the future now, it's amazing that we're still finding ways to intervene in this system.
Oh, absolutely. The field is moving. Take carotid body modulation, because we now understand how much the carotid bodies contribute to chronic sympathetic overdrive in some conditions.
Right, like resistant hypertension or CHF.
Exactly. Researchers are actively exploring ways to dampen that activity. Techniques range from surgical denervation to catheter-based ablation, even pharmacological approaches targeting the glomus cells specifically.
So potentially turning down that hyper-responsive alarm system in CHF patients to reduce their sympathetic stress.
That's the goal. It could be a game changer for managing those diseases. But flip side, imagine a patient coming for surgery who's had their carotid bodies ablated. Their ability to respond to acute hypoxia or mount a sympathetic response would be drastically different. We'd need to know that.
Wow, yeah. Then there's the really fine-tuned stuff, targeting HIF pathways or glial cells.
This is moving towards really personalized medicine. Can we develop drugs that specifically stabilize or destabilize HIF-1 or HIF-2 alpha to adjust hypoxic sensitivity? or target the glial cells that interact with chemosensitive neurons in the brainstem? Could we, for instance, develop something to ear-sensitize central chemoreceptors in OHS?
A pill to fix the broken thermostat in OHS before surgery. That would be incredible.
Huge implications for perioperative safety. And finally, as we touched on, just plain better monitoring.
Getting beyond the lag of SpO2 and just watching the patient breathe.
Right. Continuous predictive monitoring, neural respiratory drive monitors, continuous non-invasive CO2 tracking. These tools are becoming more refined and available. The goal is to see the intent of the respiratory system or the earliest signs of its failure well before overt hypoventilation or desaturation occurs.
That real-time neural data. Seeing the signal fade before the breathing stops, that's a massive safety leap.
It allows for much more nuanced management, titrating our anesthetics and ventilation based on direct physiological feedback, not just lagging indicators.
Okay, so wrapping this deep dive up, what's the final thought for you, the listener, thinking about all this? The ultimate aim seems to be tailoring anesthesia based on someone's individual chemoreceptor phenotype. If you could know before starting a case just how sensitive or blunted your specific patient's O2 alarms and CO2 thermostat really are, how might that change your anesthetic plan, your drug choices, your ventilation strategy, your post-op care in the next, say, 5 years? Something to ponder.
That was a really vital exploration, I think. These molecular sentinels are just fundamental to everything we do.
Yeah, absolutely. So key takeaways. Remember that framework. Peripheral chemoreceptors. Fast, O2-focused alarms using that potassium channel switch. Central chemoreceptors, slower, CO2 pH sensing thermostats in the CSF.
And the clinical bottom line, our main anesthetic agents, especially volatiles and opioids, actively blunt both systems. And when you see that sudden, hypertensive, tachycardic response to rising CO2, think unmasked chemoreflex first. Fix the ventilation. That's almost always step one.
Safe practice really comes down to knowing the physiology, using your monitors diligently, choosing drugs thoughtfully based on their known mechanisms, and reacting quickly and logically when things change, understanding the why behind the numbers. Thanks for joining us on today's episode of Optimal Anesthesia. For in-depth notes, visuals, and bonus content, head over to optimalanesthesia.com. Support the learning, support the craft. See you in the next one.